You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Mina Alexander. Mina, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So, Mina, we were just talking off the record before the interview began, and I was talking about, candidly, how sometimes when I interview poets, it's the most intimidating to me. And you were surprised and said, why?
Yes,
and I said, well, you know, to me it seems like one of the most sophisticated arts there are, that artists, that visual artists, even, you know, musicians, all the people that I often talk with, poetry is something they wish their work was poetic. They could never say that their work is poetic, but some of their work is, and that's what they're all reaching for, but rarely achieved. So the idea of a poet who's just turning out poetry that's beautiful seems kind of extraordinary and enormously evolved to be able to do that in terms of craft and also in terms of your art, how you're putting things together.
Well, you know, Bernard, that's very kind of you, but I do think of the poet as the most ordinary of creatures. And as I was saying, I think a poet's a bit like the fly on the wall, and we pick up little bits of dirt, and we pick up little bits of air and sunlight and maybe a bit of starlight, and something stitches together if we're fortunate. But, you know, I do think of music as the highest art. It's so interesting because I think of poetry as an art that's really etched on silence. And so that, in fact, words are always, I think, straining for what actually cannot be said. And so in some ways, it is also an impossible art, even as I think of it as very ordinary. And by ordinary, I mean, you know, when you think about children, I mean, they start with an immense sense of language and rhythm and repetition. You know, so all these are elements that come into how the poem is made. And I think poetry is actually very, you know, quote-unquote natural, you know? It's not something distant from us, I think. I think it's something very intimate and small.
That's very interesting. I mean, you're certainly making me feel much better. and that's very interesting. You just said, you know, for you, music is how I'm approaching poetry. Why do you see music that way?
Well, I think that music, you know, it exists in time. It does not occupy space. And so except, you know, as opposed to, say, a sculpture or installation piece, except insofar as it moves temporally, as it moves in time. And then it vanishes. There's a kind of abolition of the music after it's actually sounded or played or exists. And very often when I write a poem, I do feel as though I'm trying to catch music of some sort that really cannot be put into words. So sometimes I think of the poem as really existing almost in the gaps between the words. When I was at Yaddo some years ago, I made friends with a composer, and I watched how he composed on one of these enormous, you know, this computer program called Sibelius, I think it's called, and, you know, how these notes were, and the kinds of connections and loops that were made so that time itself exists as a series of recurrences and alterations and perhaps abrupt snippets that are gaps, that are cuttings. And I thought, you know, this is so much more like the way a poem is made than the way a prose narrative is made, at least certain kinds of prose narrative. So it just, you know, it just sort of made sense to me, and I thought, my God, you know, if only one could do that. But then I suppose we're trying with words to do something like that, right?
Well, but as you said earlier, with words, they always seem to be, I'm not quite sure the phrase you use, but almost like in poetry is almost an impossible art, because words and prose, we're trying to say things all the time that we seem that we don't quite have the words for, that always misses the mark a little bit. I mean, artists particularly have this problem, visual artists, in writing about their work. It's never adequate. It's the most frustrating task they can do.
Well, in a way, you can't really say anything except in the way that you do it. In other words, if you ask a poet, if someone says to me, what's this poem about, I can never, ever say, because, I mean, if I could say it, I probably wouldn't write it. And I imagine it's analogous to a painter, that how can you say this is about that? But on the other hand, I often admire the intricate theoretical ways in which artists can talk about their work. And I keep thinking, if only I could talk like that about my work, but I sort of can't, you know?
That's very interesting. Yeah, a lot of artists feel different ways about it. Artists tend to talk about, when you say theory, I think of artists talking about the ideas behind their work, of what they're trying to be. There's an awful lot of talk like that, whether their work is in a political sphere or whether they're a social activist or something but you could talk like that if we were talking about migration or something, couldn't you?
I suppose I could. I mean, that would be different from saying, what is this poem about or what does it mean? But I certainly could talk about, you know, some of the stuff that goes into the making of the poem or some of the biographical stuff or whatever, or the political, you know, for instance, the whole question of the body is something that I keep, particularly the female body, is something that I keep returning to, and I'm fascinated by the migrant body, you know, what it means to have moved between continents, and how that affects, you know, memory, how it affects really the present.
That's true, but you mean how it affects the present in terms of where you're thinking of moving, or let's talk about that a little bit.
I sort of mean like, you know, if I take, I often kind of walk a little bit when I write or when I'm trying to figure out a poem. So one of my favorite walks is through Central Park, starting at 63rd Street on Central Park West and then just going eastwards. And there's a rock right by the road on 63rd Street where I often stop and I sit. And what I love about that particular rock is it reminds me of a rock I used to kind of sit near when I was a child in India. I know it's not in India. This is in a metropolitan city, in a New York City. And I was there one day when I was reading, many years ago, when I was reading Allen Ginsberg's Rajasthan Journals, and then I got news of his death. So I started composing an elegy for him where I imagined him in the park meeting Mirabai, who is this medieval poet saint of India. So, you know, in other words, it isn't just different places, but it's also different times that can cross. But I think for that, you do need the present. I mean, I often think that, you know, New York allows me to live in this extraordinary present where memories and sensations from different parts of my life, whether it's India or part of my childhood in North Africa, I also lived for some years in Europe, all of this sort of can come together, you know, building up the work. I mean, the work, of course, only exists in your head and in your body till you actually make the rhythms and make the lines and, you know, revise it and keep revising. So that's what I mean by alter the present. You know, after 9/11, there was we were all here, and it was a, you know, very painful time. And I remember at the Drawing Center, it was the New York Foundation for the Arts put together a group of artists to talk about how one could make art in response to it. And there was a painter, there was a dancer, Lara Lubavitch, and a bunch of people. You know, they had invited me too. And I said, well, you know, there's a way in which when we do not have words, it might be possible to make a poem. And I don't know if I actually said that, but I sort of felt it. And I'd started to make some lines. Now, is that poem of any use? Obviously, it's not. It might have been more useful if I'd gone and helped in, you know, at Ground Zero or something. But for me, the thing I can do best, perhaps, is to write a few lines. And, you know, whether 2 people read it or 10 people read it, I'm very grateful if someone does, because it's just a way of crystallizing emotion. And actually, someone did set that to music. And I think that, you know, there's a way in which I think a poem can catch the emotion that we actually can't reveal necessarily in our everyday lives, or we just don't have the space to cope with it. I mean, it is an art that deals in the emotions, I think, poetry. Maybe all.
Well, I think so too, and you're talking about it as the writer, as the poet, but certainly for the viewer, for the reader, that's the case. That's how I would see it as well. Right? I mean, because we're talking about how the world also experiences poetry, perhaps.
Right. And the place I wrote wrote something in a new edition of my memoir called Lyric in a Time of Violence, because I was trying to think about what is the job, if you wish, of the poem in a time of great difficulty. You know, because as a child also, you know, Bernard, I had lived at the edge of a war zone. I mean, all the years that we were in Sudan, we were quite safe in Khartoum, in a kind of expatriate community. But there was the war with the South, you know, the terrible civil war. And then years after I left, the awful troubles in Darfur.
So wait a minute. Let me just frame that for the audience. That was what year? And I mean, how old were you then when we were talking about
this? Well, you
know, Sudan?
I crossed the Indian Ocean with my mother on a ship to meet my father, who had been posted to Sudan by the Indian government. He was a scientist. And I was 5 years old, and I was 5 years old in 1950. I was born in 51, so I was 56. I was 5 years old. But you know, I stayed in Sudan. I went back and forth between Sudan and India every year of my life till I was 18, when I went to England to study. So this is, you know, the earlier part of my life, and it's also another century, actually, you know. But I find that many of those themes and issues are vibrant and resonant for me now. I mean, we've become more and more a world that is united by migrations from the most terrible instances, as you find with the migrants pressing in, you know, escaping very, very difficult conditions in Africa and in the Middle East, coming into Europe and, you know, not really having a place where they can be, and living in very hard conditions in Europe. It's always in the news now. To people like myself who come in search of a life where they can produce their work. And for me, New York has been a wonderful home in that way. It has allowed me really to bring together these different strands of my life, which I do think otherwise I would have found it very hard, you know, to do.
You mean New York is extraordinary in that particular way, that all of these elements, like the rock you mentioned before, or so many things come together to kind of create an experience that sounds like it taps into all these memories of so many things that you've done or places
been. I think New York has, I'm very fortunate. I mean, I feel that it's given me this extraordinary palimpsest of a city. You know, it's ethnically very diverse. It's an amazing art scene. I also often write poetry when I'm sitting in the subway. I love going underground. I used to be terrified of it when I first came because, you know, I'd lived in Europe and really never used a metro very much, you know. But I actually ride in buses and on the subway. And I once remember in one of my books of poems, I have this poem which I wrote in the subway. You know, it's called Love in the Afternoon or something. But I find that there's something in the motion that releases me, that just allows my imagination to start moving. And I think, you know, Bernard, it's the idea of movement that is so crucial. I mean, recently I published a poem called Moksha, which in Sanskrit means liberation. And it's a poem evoking a terrible murder rape, actually a rape of a woman who in Delhi at the end of 2012, and she was called Nirbhaya, which means the one without fear. And I was so haunted by this. I was actually in Parma in Italy when this happened, and I started working on the poem. And then it took me, you know, I brought it to New York. I couldn't finish it. Then I took it to the mountains in India where I was last year for 6 months. And there somehow I was able to complete it. And I think my mind moved to it because this terrible event happened in a moving bus. And actually that poem is being used by the Polish artist Monika Weiss in her art film, which is called Laments. And
I know, actually, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I interviewed Monika Weiss about
that
film, and she discussed, of course, that horrific incident as well.
Right. And Buzz Spector actually had a conversation with the two of us about the differences in the arts and things like this, and making this, you know, this work. But yeah, I mean, I think for me, you know, you see, there's something else, which is that I was giving a reading some years ago in Colorado. I had never been there. I was so excited because I'd never seen, you know, the Rocky Mountains and like this. And it was this big room, and it was filled with people because it was part of a festival. And the mountains were behind, and the moon, it was dark, and the moon was just sort of visible above the mountains. And after I finished my reading, I remember a woman, you know, was wearing a red sweatshirt. She sort of stood up at the back of the room and put her hand up, and she said something that completely took my breath away. And, you know, I just didn't know what to say. And I don't know if you've been in that situation where someone asks you something in a public setting and you don't know what to say. And I literally stood there like an idiot. And I think, I don't know how long it was. It felt like an hour, but it was probably a minute or something. And then, you know, some words sort of shot out of my mouth. Because what she said to me was, what use is poetry? And she said that, you know, in that very blunt, forceful way. But I could also see it really meant something to her, that question. And then there I was standing like an idiot, you know, there. And then suddenly I felt these words sort of come out of my mouth. And I said, we have poetry so we don't die of history. And she looked at me, and I looked at her. And she said, what do you mean by that? And I said, I don't really know. I just said it. But, you know, I've been thinking about that.
I like that. I like that very much. Her question was, what was the use of poetry? Well, what is the use of poetry, correct?
Right. Or something like, what use is poetry? I mean, what use is it, you know, to anybody?
I like that. So we don't die of history. You know, I mean, that brings me to something I want to ask you, too, in perhaps in closing this interview. But, you know, there are... When visual artists hang work or have a show, there are hopefully people who see it and enjoy it or respond to it, right? This is what an artist wants. You hang your work and you get a response. A poet writes poems and, you know, people have to read them. And it's a very different world, but, you know, though you can't teach anybody how to read, people must be reading less poetry now. Isn't that the case? And is that something like, you know, in the art world, we don't talk so much about all the people that maybe aren't as sensitive as we'd like them to be to art, but that's there, you know, that people are buying art for other reasons than that they feel that it's saying something that can't be said any other way, for example. With poetry and being a poet, is there a similar kind of conversation like that among poets, or how do you feel about that? In other words...
Well, I think there are two things. One is, I have to tell you, it's an excellent question. At a very personal level, I'm really envious of my artist friends that they have a physical object and that people actually come in and look at it and then maybe talk about it. Whereas I feel that with poems, you know, it exists... It may maybe this is part of the way it's made. It exists in a kind of silence. So people do write to me sometimes or say to me, you know, I saw your poem or this, or someone can say, what use is it, or something like this. But we don't have that physical space that holds the work, which is also, of course, the nature of the art, and it's part of its power that you can memorize a poem. You know, always, I think, throughout history, people have been able to commit poems to memory that they have then recited, you know, starting with the great oral traditions, but also writers in prison have composed in their head and written on tiny scraps of paper. As to whether poetry is read less now, I think that the book, it's harder, I think, to make a book and to feel that it's really reaching a lot of people. But there are many kinds of poetry, not the kind that I write, but there are many kinds of poetry. There's hip-hop and there's rap and there's spoken word, which has huge audiences of young people, and that's fantastic. The kind of work that I do is quite intricate, and it lives in the rhythm and on the page. But it's, you know, and sometimes from time to time you give a reading, and then, you know, it's more immediate perhaps. But I think there's something else that I should say, that I do think a poem has to be read many times, and perhaps read in a quiet place. Which is not to say that you cannot recite a poem at a public meeting or at a political event, right? It is both these, and I think it's the intimacy, perhaps, that paradoxically gives it its place in the public world.
Mina, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time and your work.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIVC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.